Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Now, the U.S. government is pouring money straight into U.S. banks, becoming part owner. This is brand new, and it's not over yet. We will not stand down, said Fed Chief Ben Bernanke yesterday, until the U.S. is on the road to prosperity again. But for now, it's still crisis time. This hour, On Point, perspective on the rescue and the road ahead with investment pioneer John Bogle and progressive economist Jared Bernstein. We have two big guests with us today with different perspectives. Joining me first from Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, is John Bogle. He's founder and longtime CEO of the Vanguard Group, one of the very largest mutual fund groups in the world. He invented the first index mutual fund back in 1975, investing across the broad stock market. He's been a tough critic of investment practices in recent years. His latest book, out next month, is Enough: True Measures of Money, Business, and Life. John Bogle, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, and good to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you. And joining us from Washington is Jared Bernstein, senior economist and director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute. He's on the advisory committee of the Congressional Budget Office, wrote recently that the implosion rocking financial markets is the sound of conservative ideology collapsing. His latest book is Crunch, Why Do I Feel Squeezed? Another Unsolved Economic Mysteries. Jared Bernstein, good to have you back as well.
Thank you for inviting me, Tom.
Just to get a sense from each of you first, and John Bogle, first to you, where are we in this crisis?
Well, there are two different elements that are involved here. One is, where are we in the stock market, which is what everybody seems to be focused on at the moment. It's taken about a 40% header, one of the larger declines of
history.
I was going to actually limit it a little bit to say the 10 bear markets that I've been through personally experienced during my career, but two of them did get to 50%, so we're not at the worst one yet. So, and the other is what happens to the economy, and it's the second one that is far more important than the first, because the stock market, very speculative machine going on there, and basically you should look at the stock market, I think, Tom and Jared, as speculators trading with other speculators. I often describe its daily movements as a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
Except our retirement accounts and all our hopes and dreams, that's all.
But that has very little, if anything, to do with the daily moves of the stock market. In the long run, the stock market is going to give you the same returns that business earns, a simple truism. And in that sense, with all these jumps in the market, as I said in my previous book, Little Book of Common Sense Investing, the stock market is a giant distraction to the business of investing. But to move from the stock market now for a second, we can follow up a little bit on this later on, to the economy. And I think that's going, we're obviously going into some tough times. I've said for a long while we're in a recession. That seems to be the consensus now. The measures are kind of peculiar for a formal recession and not worth paying much attention to. But that the bottom of the recession that we're now in could be, I'd say, somewhere between 1 to 2 years away.
The bottom a year or two away. Never mind the recovery.
That's when the recovery would begin.
Jared Bernstein, so many questions here. Early this week, with the enormous quick run-up on Monday in the Dow, people, you know, a lot of people, I'm sure, hoping against hope that this crisis was behind us. Stock market and economy, two different things, but very linked. Where do you see us in the arc of this crisis we've tumbled into?
Well, I'm afraid we're somewhat in the middle of it. The interventions that the government has taken into financial markets are just head spinning. Every day you open up your newspaper and you find out that economic officials are doing something you didn't even know they had the purview to do. In fact, sometimes I'm not sure they did. The Federal Reserve going into the commercial paper market, the direct equity injections into banks that we were reading about this morning, which initially wasn't the plan for this $700 billion bailout, but the language was vague enough that they could do it. Mm-hmm. I would say we may be in the middle innings in terms of the financial markets, and that's a positive. This is sort of glass half full, mm-hmm. half empty view. I mean, that's a positive thing in the sense that we are moving towards a bottom. Unfortunately, every time we see a light at the end of the tunnel, it turns out to be a freight train headed at us. There are more banks to fail. Banks are deeply undercapitalized. This $250 billion injection, the first installment, mm-hmm. is I wouldn't say it's a drop in the bucket, but it's a few cups in the bucket. At the same time, as John correctly pointed out, there's the real economy that is absolutely unequivocally in a recession, has been there for a while. The good thing about we're going to talk about this a lot. I mean, mm-hmm. the question, very important questions about how we got here. It's my view that much of what is going on was preventable. That said, I will say that, and there's somewhat of a bumbling Keystone Cop thing to this that you don't want to see. But we are taking interventions that need to be taken. This is not the Great Depression. This is not the Japanese 90s where policymakers sat on their hands and sort of twiddled their thumbs and hoped it would all get better. Mm. It is true that we're moving in fits and starts and making mistakes we shouldn't have made. But I do believe that these interventions are helping and will help.
We'll look at those and how we got here. John Bogle, just on that front, same from you. The bottom of this recession, you're saying a year or two away. Does this mount up in your long view to a depression?
Well, I mean, I guess that's a definitional matter. A mild depression is probably not very much different from a severe recession. But I don't think the word depression should be part of the conversation. I'm not trying to split hairs over a word, but I agree with Jared that the idea of a depression such as we had really the last time was in the early 1930s. I think that's a highly unlikely, a highly improbable event.
What do you think brought us to this pass, John? We've talked in recent years. You've been very critical of many practices on Wall Street, but it's not just speculation that got us here, or maybe you think it is. How would you put in a nutshell, how would you describe to somebody from Mars what put the American economy in position to tumble so badly right here?
Well, I guess I'd say, and this is a way to spread the blame pretty or the responsibility pretty broadly. I think right out of Pogo, we have met the enemy, and he is us. And that is, it's the American citizenry, the attitudes and values of our society that have changed little by little over the years, where we've gotten to expect more and more and more, and pay later and later and later, and an enormous monument of mountain of debt has crept up on us from the wealthiest, from the big financial institutions. It was one of the reasons they're in trouble is they didn't worry enough about leverage. These institutions that have failed, and even those that are still going, sometimes had had a dollar of capital for every $33 on their balance sheet. That's what we call 33-to-1 leverage, meaning a 3% decline in the value of the assets wipes out the capital. And so that's pretty extreme. And then the quality of the balance sheet, low quality in particular, particularly these mortgage-backed obligations were there. But their part only, it's kind of the part we can read and count and think about. But basically it's a society where we had the idea that we don't do the old way. Save money so you can buy a new car, or a new dishwasher, or whatever it might be. And now it's buy it now and pay for it later, and don't pay any interest for the first year. It's kind of typical. Mm. We've had a mountain of credit card debt. We've had mortgage debt of extreme proportions, particularly going to people without any adequate credit standing, credit worthiness, one might say. Mm. And so it comes with very cheap money. Very importantly, important part of this is for about 3 years in a row, we had negative real interest rates. That is to say, the interest rate was less than the rate of inflation. Mm. So you could basically borrow money with apparent impunity, and that obviously has to come to an end.
John, hold the thought. I want to get Jared in here, our progressive economist. Jared, here's John Bogle, who helped bring the middle class to Wall Street and Wall Street to the middle class. Now he looks at the sort of devastation here and says, you know, the enemy is us. It's the American culture. It's the American citizenry. What do you say to that?
Well, I guess I don't really agree. I think I could summarize the problem in one word, and that's ideology. I think there was an ideology that led to, I'm not disagreeing with much of the story that John just told, but I don't think it came out of nowhere. I think there was an ideology that came out of a very unfortunate collision between a certain type of economics called neoclassical economics, based on the theory that markets equilibrate, that markets left to their own devices will discipline themselves and do the right thing, mm-hmm. and essentially assumes away bubbles. There was a collision with that and a politics that said, you don't have to pay your way. In fact, it's better than that. We can cut your taxes and generate all kinds of growth. This is supply-side trickle-down fairy dust that to this day, to this very day, and I'm talking yesterday in plans that I'm reading about in the paper this morning, politicians are still espousing. It's all part of an ideology that got us to where we are today. It's an ideology that leads to decisions to allow markets to engage in speculative excess, and for the Federal Reserve to stand by and watch it happen and even edge it along in the ways John described. To stand on the side with a set of mops saying there's nothing we can do about it, we'll just take care of it after it bursts, it leads to the kinds of tax policy we've been discussing. It leads to wars that you don't pay for. This is an ideological train wreck, and we'd better learn from it.
Two big perspectives here and one big crisis. What got us into this mess? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Go straight to questions here. Patty, Port Charlotte, Florida. You're on the air with John Bogle and Jared Bernstein.
My question I'd like to ask,
yeah.
If you drive a car at 100 miles an hour and you slam into a concrete wall, I don't understand why everybody's acting so surprised at the mess the economy's in. This has been, do you not agree that this has been coming on for 2 or 3 years? And my second point is when they cut the taxes, what are they going to do in 4 or 5 years when you have millions of baby boomers getting ready to go into retirement? Do you not think Social Security is going to completely crash at that point?
Patty, let us pick it up. John Bogle, first to you. Could we have seen this coming? Patty says 3 years ago.
Well, I was writing and talking about it 3 years ago and probably 5 years ago. I said a lot about it in my previous book,
mm-hmm,
or two previous books called The Battle for the Soul of Capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was predictable. I had an article in the Financial Analyst Journal entitled Black Monday and Black Swans, those surprising events that come along, talking about the extraordinary amount of risk we have as a nation in our society. So, you know, I think it was quite predictable.
Why didn't anybody step up then and stop it? Whose job was it? What went wrong with the system? Was it ideology, as Jared Bernstein said, that blinded us, that kept us from doing anything about it if it was so visible?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, I don't think Jared's position and mine are very different.
Mm-hmm.
He basically, I guess it's fair to say, blames the politicians. But I go one step further and blame us because we elected the politicians. You know, they gave us a message. They wanted to make credit easier. They wanted to cut taxes and run big deficits. And we not only listened to them and elected them, we the people, but we also followed, in effect, their advice, Alan Greenspan's advice. You know, there was nothing better than an adjustable rate mortgage. That these financial instruments, these derivatives that were loosed on the society, hidden from our view, not listed on any exchange, no trading records, no nothing, no knowledge of who counterparties are, the people on the other side of all these bets that we've been making.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a societal problem, and the reason I blame us is because, you know, we probably get the kind of politicians we deserve.
So is it time to change ideology then? Let me just ask you, John, I'll come to you, Jared, but are you saying, John, you're a market guy. Are you really saying enough with the infallibility of the markets? I mean, here you are, Mr. Index Fund. I would have thought market was your middle name.
Well, let me just make something very clear. I have never argued, that the index fund works because markets are efficient. The so-called efficient market
self-correcting
theory or so on is fine as far as it goes. The markets are efficient more than they're inefficient, but by no means 100% of the time. But the reason the index fund works so well is because of the low cost that it incurs. In other words, all of us investors together share the returns that business earns translated into the returns the stock market earns, but we lose to those market averages or the market itself because we have all these costs in our financial system.
These high-priced managers of mutual funds.
The high-priced managers of mutual funds, the high cost of Wall Street, all this trading. We should talk a little bit about what happened in the markets because we are on a speculative orgy the like of which has never been seen, measurably never been seen, in the financial history of the United States of America. Speculation has replaced investment as the motif, if you will, or the basic value of investors, or market participants, I should say. Because in 1929, the previous speculative high, the stock market turned over about 140% a year. Last year, it turned over at twice that rate, 280%. And this year it's turning over at 320%. And in my early years in this business, it turned over about 30% a year. So we had this speculative orgy, which involves lots of trading costs, lots of unnecessary taxes, of course, a lot of investment banking fees, and all those appurtenances of Wall Street, all those lawyers and so on, accountants, whatever, management consultants, I don't know. And I calculate the cost of the financial system as something like $600 billion a year, which by definition is the amount by which we lose to the market. So the index fund basically cuts Wall Street out of the equation, and that's why indexing wins, not because markets are efficient. It's quite clear in hindsight, and I think it was quite clear in foresight, that our banking executives, investment banking executives, were taking far too much risk. Their leverage is well known. And nobody seemed to worry about it. The quality of their balance sheets, I'm not sure they knew, these investment bankers, what was in them. But now that we have government ownership, quasi-nationalization of our banking system, partially, we are going to have much tougher regulation. And while I'm not particularly smitten with the idea of more regulation, we absolutely have to have it because you can't let people get away with murder on the upside. Privatizing enormous profits and then socializing the losses. So there will be and must be substantial additional regulation. And so I would be a great proponent of wise regulation and not just trying to, stop a lot of leaks in the ship. I think I'd redo the hull.
Jared, what do you say? Patty wants to know why this wasn't seen coming and deflected, and also how do we pay for what we do going forward if tax cuts remain? I guess this goes back to your ideology observation, the mantra of the land.
Well, first of all, I want to be clear. I am not saying broadly that politicians by any means are to blame with this. I've been in Washington since 1992. And I've worked with a lot of politicians who understood this a long time ago and have been doing their best to try to get this right. But they're a tiny minority, and they have been overwhelmed by a much larger group. And this is not bad Republicans and good Democrats. There's been bipartisan political mistakes made, who have been advised by the economics profession. And I don't mean to take such a broad swipe at economists. There are a small number, and Patty's one of them. There are a small number of economists who saw this coming. There are a set of assumptions embedded in dominant economics, as practiced by Alan Greenspan, for example. He's not the only one, but he's most visible, essentially took a Panglossian view of markets and balance and assumed that they could regulate themselves and balance themselves, and the best thing to do is stand by the wayside and wait for the crash. And obviously that served us very poorly. In terms of Patty's question and her example, it sort of gets back to this kind of semi, I agree with John, sort of a semi-disagreement I have with John. So if somebody's driving 100 miles an hour and they're going to crash into a wall, is it their fault for driving 100 miles an hour, or is it the fault of society for not enforcing speed limits? Now, you know, we have speed limits in the economy, and we've ignored them in precisely the way John mentioned, and we're going to have to reinvent them. Now, you mentioned tax increases. Mm. If this bailout is so important, and I happen to believe it is an unfortunate necessity, a necessary evil. Mm-hmm. John probably agrees that this is not something we have much of a choice about at this
point. I do agree, yes.
We've got to get the financial markets running again. Then we have to pay for it. If this war is so important, then we have to pay for it. Tax policy over the last few decades has had only one direction. You can only cut taxes, according to the dominant ideology. Now, I give Barack Obama, not to be partisan here, but just to look at the two candidates, I give Barack Obama a lot of credit for actually having a tax increase in his proposal for folks whose family incomes are above $250,000. Now, you know, you might argue, somebody might argue, well, you know, that doesn't seem very broad, but it
it's
is.
It's only 5% of the country, he always tells us.
It's even less. Uh-huh. It's even less. Mm-hmm. It's 5% of the workforce, so it's less of the population. But yet, you know, that to me shows some dimension of leadership as opposed to our president who after 9/11 said, go shopping. So by the way, John McCain back in 2001 and 2003 said it is unconscionable to cut taxes on the wealthy while we're in a time of war. I mean, he understood this at that point in time. So there were politicians who got this, and unfortunately they've been a minority.
John, would you have the courage to get into an index fund now if we've been in this speculative binge? If Jared's right and we have to pay for things now, that sounds like bringing everything down a notch, maybe a big notch, a different standard of living even, or maybe just a different baseline for the stock markets.
Okay, let me, if I might, just first respond very, very briefly to what Jared said, and I agree with basically everything he said. The time to have a tax increase was when we went to war and say, America, we're in this together. Our young men and women, our finest young men and women are out there sacrificing. And ladies and gentlemen of the American electorate, we are going to have a wartime tax. It's going to be imposed on you to pay for the war now, something like $1 trillion. And that's the way America has always done it. And we're going to do that. Now, that would take a little courage. We're now in the particular mess of saying if we want a tax increase now,
yeah,
it's the bailout Wall Street.
Right. And I don't you're think totally right, acceptable. John. This is not the time for budget austerity or tax increases. Completely.
Exactly. So in any event, coming back to the question, the index fund or owning the U.S. stock market, and this is really a very important point. In this drop in the stock market of about 40% from the high last August or October, whichever date you prefer, the value of all U.S. stocks has dropped from around $18 trillion to around $10 trillion. Mm-hmm. It's dropped by $8 trillion, the market value of our securities.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody in their right mind remotely believe that the value of American business, which is represented there, has dropped by $8 trillion in, say, 6 months or
but
8 months?
But you said it was all speculation or monumentally speculative, so it seems possible.
No, that's the speculation. Is it the expectations or the bearishness or maybe margin calls, of which we're seeing a lot, or hedge funds that are pushed to meet redemptions or mutual funds that are pushed to meet redemptions that have to sell, and they're putting selling pressure on the market, I think, and we don't have enough data really to conclude that. But the speculative moves in the market, ultimately, 100% of the value of the U.S. stock market over time is generated by the dividend yield when you buy in and the subsequent earnings growth. So we should be looking at the market today and saying a couple of things. One, historically, the dividend yield contributed 4.5% to the return of the stock market long term, 4.5% of the 9%, and 5% came from corporate earnings growth. That yield went all the way down to 1%. A deadweight loss from that 4.5% of 3.5% a year. It's now back to 3%, believe it or not, just because the market is down. So dividend yields have tripled, but are still below, tripled from the high, from the low, but are still below the long-term norm.
Does that mean that the $10 trillion remaining value of those stocks is more in line with the real value of American business now, or is it still a kind of speculative bubble?
Well, we're always going to have speculation until we change the ethos of our investment system that I described earlier with this insane turnover. Because the mantra of investing today in mutual funds and hedge funds is the folly of short-term speculation rather than the wisdom of long-term investing.
But the question is still there. Would you have the nerve to stride into an index fund today? Is $10 trillion about a reasonable place for this market to be? Or is it, you know, if that $8 trillion in value was just hooey, is there another $5 trillion of hooey in there?
Well, all I can say is the short-term movements of the stock market, I have no intention of proceeding. If everybody gets scared to death, the market could easily go down another 10 or 15 or 20%. I have no way of knowing that. But the value of business is not going to go down that much. And in the long run, it's that business value that is created for investing. So from these levels of earnings, somewhat depressed levels of earnings, I don't see any reason that corporate earnings from this relatively low level, particularly in the financial sector, which is going to have problems for a long time, I don't see any reason corporate earnings can't grow about 7% a year compared to the long-term rate of 5% because we're starting from a depressed level. So if you take that 3% yield and that 7% earnings growth, the potential, we don't know, never know, but I'm talking about over the next 10 years, earnings will double at 7% in 10 years. So that would be a 7% earnings growth and a 3% dividend yield. I think from somewhere around these levels, the stock market will ultimately deliver a return. I've been saying 6 or 7 or 8% for quite a while, but now that the market is down, I'd say the future returns ought to be in the 10% range just because we're at a depressed stage in earnings.
Sounds like a buy signal from a pretty big investor. Let me get a call from Jay in Chesapeake, Virginia. Jay, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. Corporate earnings, that is the reason that I called. I know absolutely nothing about the stock market. I have a high school education only. But let me throw this at you from what I see.
Yep.
Let's say that you're a publicly traded company on the New York Stock Exchange and you make a box of cereal. You make cereal, let's say General Mills. You get to a point with your product that you cannot enlarge your piece of the pie. You're maxed out. In order to make a profit, let's say you now start buying the ingredients from the product from the cheapest source, and that may not be in the United States. So that's a dent to the American farmer right there. Then let's say that you totally automate the process of getting that thing to the store to the max. Your productivity is off the charts. So in order to save money, you're going to have to either not give pay raises, which will lead to stagnant wages, or you, in the case of a box of cereal, look at it now in size compared to when I grew up in the late 50s and early 60s.
JR, time is short before the break, but I hear where you're going, and let me put it to Jared while there's time to respond. Jared, it sounds like, you know, you get to a teeny tiny box of cereal and no jobs associated with creating it, and suddenly we're all out of business. Is there some necessary dynamic here that pushes us to the vanishing point, Jay's afraid?
Well, I don't think it's an inevitable push to the vanishing point, but I think Jay is tapping into something important. I mean, embedded in Jay's question there is the impact of globalization on many of our workers, particularly folks like Jay who are non-college educated. I mean, the theory is very clear on this. When we trade with countries who have very large low-skill workforces like China, that puts downward pressure on the wages and jobs of folks over here in sectors as Jay mentioned. And so we absolutely need a better plan to help folks who have been hurt by globalization. Of course, the other side of the point, and Jay's question had this in it too, is that if you price globally, you end up with a cheaper box of cereal than you would have otherwise. So there it's a double-edged sword, globalization. The problem is, and it kind of gets back to what we've been talking about, it's been pure cheerleading for the last couple of decades. Now we're starting to view the downsides as well, and Jay's right. We need to do something about them, too.
We're getting down to basics here with Jared Bernstein at the Economic Policy Institute and founder and former CEO of Vanguard Mutual, John Bogle. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour with investment pioneer John Bogle and progressive economist Jared Bernstein about meltdown, bailout, rescue, and the state of the U.S. economy. John Bogle's latest book, Enough, True Measures of Money, Business, and Life, is out next month. He's founder and former CEO of the Vanguard Mutual Fund Group. Jared Bernstein joins us from Washington. John Bogle's in Valley Forge. Jared Bernstein is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, author of Crunch. You can join us. What's your question on the bailout, on the rescue road we're on the U.S. government buying into banks? Are we fully facing up yet to the fix we're in? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's take a call from Hebron, Connecticut. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Basically, I'd like to drop back a little bit to the derivatives that were mentioned earlier as far as mortgages. Now, like Jay, I have no banking background. I have no stock market background. But what I've been gathering from information on the internet and from the television shows is these derivatives were created as like fictitious monies based on, I guess, what would be equities on mortgages, suspected equities or future equities. Once these things are manipulated and transpire from bank to bank, when the housing bust came about, these portfolios became worthless. So then the shifting of monies back and forth of these portfolios from one bank to another led to, you know,
they got so big, nobody knew who owed what to who, but it is confusing. We've got a great crew here to sort of look at that. Let us pick it up, Scott. John Bogle, would you give us the short course again? Because derivatives gets tossed around as the sort of super villain in this story, and I think a lot of people are still trying to get their heads around exactly what they are, why they're so dangerous, and maybe what ought to be done now to unwind that problem and prevent it from happening again.
Okay, let me try a little bit of basics here for your listeners and for you and Jared. A derivative is simply a security whose value is based on another security, if you will. An S&P, an index future on the Standard & Poor's 500 index, takes its value from the index itself.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened, the first and most important thing about derivatives is given the Graham-Leach-Biley Act of, I guess, 6-7 years ago.
Phil Graham, who was advising John McCain earlier in his campaign, was in Senate then.
And whose wife, importantly, was at that time the head of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, got a great big exemption for these commodities. These derivatives are called commodities, or described as commodities. They're not described as securities. So they are exempt from regulation. They are exempt from reporting. We don't know who's trading them. We don't know the volume of trading. We don't know who the counterparties are. So we have a great big house of cards in the derivative market. And let me just tell you how bad it is. There are around $2 trillion worth of bonds whose credit is being insured by these derivatives, credit default swaps, they are called. And they are bets on one side or the other about whether that bond will be able to meet its interest payments and ultimately pay off its principal.
So that means I've bought some insurance that I'm going to make my return on this bond, this investment. That seems almost, how can you insure that?
Well, you find somebody to take the other side of the bet. You know, Mr. A is betting that it won't be able to, and Mr. B is betting that it will be able to. And so you arrive for a top-quality company, or a top-quality, say, AAA credit at the time, a very low premium for that kind of a credit, and a very high premium for something where it looks a little risky.
Okay.
There's nothing the matter with the system as such, except its complete opacity. But the fact of the matter is, on these $2 trillion, roughly, of bonds, there is $62 trillion of betting going on, $62 trillion of betting going on as to whether those payments will get made. That's 31 times or 30 times the amount of, roughly 30 times, the amount of the basic bonds outstanding. And the example I use, Tom, if I can just take 1 second because I think this will make it clear to your readers. Let's assume you have a house and you're insuring it for $300,000 against a fire.
Okay.
And then you've got 62 neighbors. That's the ratio here. You're one, and there are 62 of them who are betting your house will burn down, and another 62 of them who are betting it will not burn down.
Okay.
That's the dimension of the system. Now, you can say, what's wrong with that? I would argue the cost of those things is unconscionable anyway. But the real problem is you have to watch out for arsonists. You know, someone's betting your house.
There's a big incentive.
It's a big incentive. So there's huge speculation going on in these derivative markets that can often take a company down and out it seemed to happen almost largely that way for American International Group, so-called AIG, that was bailed out to the tune of so many, I've lost track, they keep coming back to the well for
85
another $30
plus
dollars
more,
so.
Plus more, yep.
Well, it began at $85 billion, they just got another $27 billion.
Right.
So it's a huge speculative carnival that's going out there in derivatives, and basically unregulated, unobserved, and opaque.
Jared, what do we do about it? Is anything proposed on the table?
2 points for Scott, and then let me quickly try to answer your question. First of all, derivatives, as John just described, are simply financial instruments that take their value from some other financial instrument. Their value and
derived.
Their price is derived. And when, as John just described, when the derivative market becomes so many multiples more expensive than that underlying value, it's a risk for precisely the kind of meltdown we're seeing right now. Originally, derivative markets weren't nearly this large, and so the risks were not amplified. But when you get that 62 to 2 trillion dollar ratio, that's pure amplification of risk. And then here's the second thing. Scott, you might really want to look at the cover story of the Washington Post today. This is a fascinating story of how back in the 1990s, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, run by a woman whose name I'm blanking on right now, tried to implement a regulatory regime because she recognized precisely what John and I are talking about
now.
But she recognized it, yes, the danger. She recognized it over a decade ago. And she was blocked in ways that are detailed in this argument by Greenspan, by Bob Rubin. You'll see in the article. Now, how do we get to where we need to go to answer your question, Tom? Well, I think we go back to people precisely like this very salutary person who recognized this 10 years ago, and we bring this shadow economy into the light. I mean, the disinfectant of sunshine is what this derivative market needs, and I'm sure John would agree.
Amen, is what I would say.
But if you bring it into the light, is it going to be so ugly we're all going to freak out? And
It will initially be extremely ugly. And we'll have to deal, but that's okay. Better the ugly you know than the ugly you don't.
Wow. Let's go to Ed in Nashville, Tennessee. Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've got a quick question. I remember average working Joe, and I happen to have read Den of Thieves, and I remember Michael Milken and Carl Icahn. And I was just wondering, I heard the FBI is investigating this. But is anybody tracking the money? And that's the 400 executives that were involved in this, and their estimated worth was over $450 billion. Why can't the American people recoup some of these losses, regardless of the derivatives and all the other things that are making my eyes glaze over?
Hang in there, Ed. But Jared, how about it? Ed remembers Michael Milken. He went to prison. Should people go to prison in this meltdown? Who?
Some people should, and perhaps some people will. Most people won't. By the way, the woman's name who ran the CTFC was Brooksley Bourne. The question is: were laws broken, or was that speed limit up to 100 miles per hour, and people were acting recklessly, but not breaking the law? You know, Milken broke the law; he was guilty of illegal trading. There's some interesting research, really top-rate journalism, finally coming out around this issue. That's looking at what folks did to get us where we are today. I just mentioned that article in the Post.
Yep.
Nobody broke the law there. They just decided, based on ideology, that regulation was unnecessary because, and you'll see quotes from Greenspan in that article, markets can regulate themselves. But if you go down to the level of the rating agencies, that's RAT, rating agencies, that were supposed to rate the quality of many of these financial instruments, some of these agencies were not just sloppy. It looked to me like they were negligent. And I don't know what kind of laws are invoked there, but it seems to me that they may have broken some laws by saying they were going to do one thing and not doing it. That is, saying they were actually going through these instruments, looking at their credit quality. When they didn't go through them at all, they just took somebody else's rating and called it their own.
So it may be sheriffs who come into play here. It may just be voters, if it's ideology really pushing this. Let me get a call from Ripton, Vermont, and Caroline. Caroline, you're on the air.
Thank you. Calling from Alaska, visiting from Alaska. Great discussion, gentlemen. I want to go back to the discussion of the responsibility of every one of us. I've been watching all of this stuff since in the early 50s. And I remember the one president who asked for sacrifice was Jimmy Carter, and he got kicked out quickly enough. When people are so self-absorbed, and when it doesn't hurt them, then they don't care what goes on. They don't care if the blue-collar jobs in the textile industry go 35 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever. They care whenever it's their white-collar job that gets out exported to very well-educated countries like India and so forth. That's when they care. So until this hurts, and it hurts enough people, we will let it go. It'll be the cheerleaders still out there treating us like infantile two-year-olds in the sandbox, and we will only care for ourselves.
Well, it hurts right now, Carolina. Who are you thinking might lead us out of that pain?
I think it's going to be people who are honest, who will be honest with us, who will go after their friends that broke the law, that committed fraud. Now, again, fraud is something that is sometimes hard to prove, and if you don't want people punished, then you don't put enough regulators and prosecutors in place to do it. So it is like a pile of spaghetti. Try and find one end that is the cause. It's impossible.
You're from Alaska. What about your governor there, Caroline? You're from Alaska. What about Governor Palin? What about the cut of her jib
on this?
I've
been there over 40 years. I worked in broadcasting. This person is one of the major disasters and such an embarrassment to our state.
Why?
Take it from there. Don't even consider her an expert in.
But she's very, very popular in Alaska. We read 80% approval rating. That's through the roof.
And that's part of the problem with this nation. If you have enough of a cheering squad, and you have enough lobbyists that are buying enough politicians, and they get to write all the rules, and nobody cares until it hits them in the face, then you're going to have people like that rising to prominence. It's marketing. Yeah, and that's all that we have been driven on for the last 40, 50 years. It's marketing. We've not had a major hurt in this country since World War II. And I hate to think we're going to get to that, but it may be what's necessary for people to realize we're all a community. And if there are kids in schools that are lousy, you better not take an attitude, well, we need a permanent underclass to fight our wars. You better take the attitude that there are geniuses out there. We don't know where they are. We don't know what color, sex they are. We have to give everybody an opportunity, and we've not been doing that for a very long time.
There's a responsibility message. Let me get one more from Burlington, Vermont. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi. I got a question about the 15% tax rate on capital gains and how this has helped to fuel all these issues.
John McCain wants to cut that down to 7% for a time as part of his emergency economic package here. What do you think, Phil?
Well, I think that, you know, if I had a chance to turn all my income that I possibly could into a capital gain, that I would. And I think that's what has been happening with most of these issues on, like, you know, credit default swaps, et cetera. They tried to do everything they could in order to increase their asset value of their company. And that would help out whenever they get their stock options. And so you're turning your income into something that you get half of your tax cut for.
Capital gains with a pretty advantageous tax rate. John Bogle,
right,
what about John McCain saying, let's cut it back down to 7%? Do you see that as somehow an economic kickstart? I wasn't sure how that would work here.
I think that's absolutely absurd. And the reason I think so, and I haven't seen anybody else mention this simple fact, and that is it was only maybe 50 years ago, not very long as time goes, where institutions, financial institutions, own 8% of all stocks and individual investors own 92%. Today, these financial institutions own 76% of all stocks and individuals own 24%. Now, the important point about that on taxes is that almost all of that 76% institutional holding is exempt from capital gains tax. They don't pay any capital gains taxes if you're a pension fund, if you're in 401k as an individual investor, if you're an endowment fund manager. None of that gets paid. And to make matters even worse, these hedge fund managers and private equity managers have somehow managed to finagle a 15% tax rate on what they call the carry, not a very good term for the incentive fees.
So they're paying that low rate. But why do you say, John McCain, it's absolutely absurd to call for a capital gains tax cut now?
Because you're cutting capital gains taxes on a very small and maybe even tiny part of the population, given all these tax-deferred holdings.
Can I amplify that?
Yes,
I actually wrote a piece. I wrote a piece on this morning. It's on the Huffington Post. The benefits. John is 100% right. The benefits of the of this proposed cut by McCain. Let me tell you what share of the benefits flow to the middle class. Ready? 0.2%. Their average tax bill gets cut by $4. They get a gallon of gas out of this plan. 98% goes to the top fifth. It's trickle-down economics. The thinking here, Tom, and you said, why do this? The thinking here is that instead of trying to directly create jobs, say, through infrastructure investment or target a tax cut at the middle class, the idea here is that if you cut taxes of those at the very top of the scale, they'll create more economic activity and it will trickle down. As you can tell from things I've said today, my writing, that's never worked.
And you don't see it with McCain right now. Our time is short, and the list of questions just goes on and on. We're getting a kind of real-time education in this crisis. John Bogle, what grade do you give Paulson, Bernanke so far in their response?
Well, I was quoted, I think I was speaking a little bit loosely, as saying that the administration, including both the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department, seemed a little punch drunk with the present economic and business situation, and they have gone. I mean, I'd give them probably a C plus or a B, but they go from one plan to another plan, and then another plan. It's kind of like putting a tourniquet on the most recent wound. What they call TARP, Troubled Asset Program, or whatever. And we had to pass that, but they should have been thinking about a broad economic solution like that instead of a spot solution, which we had going back all the way to the Bear Stearns case almost a year ago now. So I think I wouldn't give them a high grade, but they are at least doing something now at long last to coordinate a federal response, a Treasury and Federal Reserve response, that whether it's the right one or not, we don't know, but at least they're going down the road of realizing the incredible seriousness of the financial situation we face.
Little by little, we're learning. Unfortunately, we may have more time in this ditch to figure it out than we'd wish. John Bogle, author of Enough, coming out next month. Thank you very much for being with us, John.
Great to be with you.
And Jared Bernstein at the Economic Policy Institute. Thanks for your time today, Jared.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.